Welcome to the Trad to Indie panel. I'm Rach Shelkey. I am a co-host of It's Like D&D Plus One Forward, The Gauntlet. I also am part of the organization committee for Breakout, which is a gaming convention in Toronto, and part of the RPG admin group for Fan Expo Canada.
So I have most of the same credits. I'm one of the organizers for the Toronto Area Gamers, which is 2,500 gamers in Toronto.
Also that.
Monthly and weekly meetups. I'm part of Breakout. I'm part of Fan Expo's RPGs. And so we run a lot of games. We organize a lot of games for people. We help get a lot of new people into games, and help people find new games they didn't expect to try. And that's sort of what this panel's about, is how to get rid of some of those barriers of, I've played a lot of D&D, or I've played a lot of this. How do I try the next thing? How do I get into the, you know, where to go from there? The number one piece of advice is just play every game.
Yeah. Play every game that's presented in front of you. That's really the end of the panel. Just play everything. You are welcome to play anything. Do not let anyone stand in the way between you and playing a game.
And, I mean, so that's if you take anything away, that's it. Panel's over. We're going to dissect that a little bit, I guess. But that's the thing is there's a lot of, and I think D&D is bad for this because it comes with a lot of books, because they're trying to sell a new book every month, and it feels like do I need to know all of these things? Do I need to memorize all of these rules? A lot of the time, certainly at any of our spaces and a lot of convention spaces like this one, the GM is there to be an ambassador to the table. They're getting people who've never heard of role-playing games or never heard of a thing sit down at the table. They're the one, you know, teaching you the game in 5 minutes, and you're playing and you're getting the feel for it, and that's what it's all about. So just go sit down at those spaces and don't feel like you don't belong there or need to know something ahead of time.
Yeah, so to back up, the panel is marketed as a how to transition from quote-unquote traditional RPGs to indie RPGs. Traditional RPGs, for the purposes of this panel, we're going to define as D&D and Pathfinder and all those games that have a large market share and easily accessible. Those are ones that you can find at your local store usually playing. That's not everyone's gateway. I know it's certainly not my gateway into the hobby, but I think it was yours.
Absolutely, yeah. D&D in high school was the
So, and indie games, for the purposes of this discussion, is going to refer to game design approaches that are a reaction or a commentary to the, quote-unquote, again, traditional RPG design. So we're going to talk about a couple of games that do come from fairly large publishing houses that are considered a little bit unusual or more story game focused, or definitely do not function like against standard RPGs.
So there's a marketing trick here that it's worth knowing about, and that people sell more games when they create an in-crowd and an out-crowd, an in-crowd of people who know a little bit about the game or know a lot, and an out-crowd. Having that about your game sells more games. People do it intentionally. Apocalypse World did it intentionally. And you can see that with D&D and other games, it generates buzz. It gets people talking and arguing about your game. It's a marketing tool that generates games, but it's a barrier to new people going to play games. And so it's just being aware that this exists is the number one step to, oh, they're marketing to me. That's just like a poster. That's an advertisement, this incredible. I don't need to know any of that. I can still sit and play this. It's for me. All games are for everybody.
Yeah, it's an anxiety trigger for some people getting into RPGs. When we run one-shots, we get people who are like, I really want to play this, but I wasn't sure when was the right time to jump in. That's why we say just play everything. And again, Vincent Baker in particular has been transparent, saying Apocalypse World uses loaded jargon because he saw Free Market use loaded jargon, and he delighted in the in-crowds and out-crowds that caused in the audiences, and he wanted to craft that as part of the Apocalypse World experience.
So don't let that stand in your way.
So to start, where do you start with games that are different? And what everyone is going to cite is you want to take a step back and think about genre. Genre is a great way to sort of focus on which particular games that you're interested in, because there is a huge spectrum of games on the market. If you go to DriveThruRPG, which is where a lot of these indie small press games exist, it is going to be impossible to sift through to even find a starting point. So find a genre you're interested in. The indie movement in particular loves playing around with the idea of genre. You'll find a lot of indie designers be like, oh, I'm consuming all of this mecha anime because I need to write a mecha show, so I have to digest it all and take it apart and then figure out what is my position on it and how do I convert that into a game. That's super common. A game designer's approach to a genre may not always mesh with your own. So when you go following genre, it's okay to look at a product that you think of as being, that may be appealing, that looks like it's selling to you, but is in fact not quite what you like in the genre, because there's always going to be something else.
Give me an example of that.
Just trying to think off the top of my head. Oh, Spirit of 77. Spirit of 77, a lot of people like referring to this as a game about 1970s cinema. My background is in media. There is no genre of 1970s media. It's referring to a particular flavor of gonzo exploitation media that existed towards the middle, late 70s. It's a little bit of a spillover from the 1960s as well. So I have people like, oh yeah, 1970s. Like, you're not going to run Sorcerer or The Exorcist in Spirit of 77. That's going to be a really weird game.
But you are going to have high-flying kung fu action and a guy who's in a truck with his pet chimp and, you know, ninjas and rock stars and exploitation-y films and all of that mashed into one game. Anything that's sort of in that's Spirit of 77. And it's fun, it's action-packed, it's really cool at doing those things and playing with that. It's just not, you know, it says I'm all 70s, but it's, you know, it's a specific slice of that genre.
If I want to run Super Train to make a really deep cut there in terms of a reference, I would use Spirit of 77, and no one would sign up for my game. Apocalypse World is another one. I find running it publicly, it falls into the trap that you get a lot of people who want to play the alpha survivor story in Apocalypse World, and that's not really what Apocalypse World is about. There are classes in that game that are being the biggest badass you could possibly be, but then you have many other parts of that game that are about building the community and examining, because in Apocalypse World, it's specifically 50 years after the end happened, what does humanity look like now? Which is that I'm going to be the person who survives the apocalypse because here's all these skills that make me an outsider in modern society, and now I'm going to be awesome.
So do you have a game that you feel like perfectly encapsulates a genre that you really love?
I am fascinated by slice of life anime, and I really like Golden Sky Stories as a way to encapsulate that idea of low-level magic, characters that are more focused on their relationships with each other and how that empowers them. And that game, because those your stats are derivative of how you feel towards other characters and NPCs. So the more you work on your relationships and build your relationships out, the more magic you have access to. And all the magic is very low-level stuff with a few exceptions. So you could be the bird and give everyone wings because you're going to have that magical moment where you can see everything from above. But it's not, I guess a perfect example there is the designer intentionally left out combat mechanics because in earlier builds there were combat mechanics and then everyone started solving problems using violence in the playtests. And his reaction was, I believe it's a he, was this isn't what this game is about. How do we fix it? Oh, we're just going to take it out entirely.
And I think another thing that game does that's really cool is so you've got this pile of dreams that you're called and you're handing them out. And it's just it's a really simple, hey, if you do something cute or funny or friendly, that's what this game is about. So if you do that, everybody around the table, grab some of those dreams and throw them that way. And that's your experience points. You're leveling up after every scene and you're just getting, when you do something that's awesome and in genre and so perfect, they're throwing buckets of these things at you. And that's a really great mechanic of like immediate reward for doing the thing the game wants you to do. And so it says I'm about this genre and then has a mechanic that makes it about this genre.
Yeah, it also normalizes the environment of the table because you're reinforcing behavior between the other players. When someone does, it's on something helpful, something cute, or something that emotionally moves you. That's when you reward dreams. That's your starting point. And eventually the players are like, yeah, you did something amazing. Let's go give you more little crystals or chips or whatever you're using. But it means that people who aren't always in that mindset go, well, I want the thing too. And then it tends to sort of standardize behavior a little bit. It keeps things in tone. What was an example you had written down?
So I really love Marvel Heroic Role-Playing by Margaret Weiss Productions. It's out of print now, but it came out a couple of years ago. But it really feels like those games are playing a Marvel comic. And you've still got, you know, the Hulk and his best friend, and they're mechanically balanced, and so nobody feels like I'm not having any fun because the Hulk is smashing everything and I have nothing to do. I'm just, you know, everybody is contributing just as much, and it's sort of like you'd see in the comic books. Nobody's losing their share of the amount of time on the page or the panels they're in. but the power levels are sort of evened out a little bit or made less important, because that's not the key thing about comics. It's about the relationships between these people, and it's about the drama created in those scenes and the big obstacles, and everybody's always contributing to those in little ways, and this game empowers everybody to do that.
Yeah, I'm going to take a step back. I want to make it clear where people can get a hold of these games. Golden Sky Stories is on DriveThruRPG as a PDF. It is in print and readily accessible through Indie Press Revolution and other role-playing booksellers. You should be able to get it through normal distribution channels. Marvel Heroic Roleplaying is out of print, but they did multiple print runs of the core book, so you're usually able to find it fairly easily. It might take a little bit of hunting. The PDFs are now sadly discontinued, so but you may be able to acquire them other ways.
If you weren't looking at a genre, what's some other slice of way you could look at indie games and find cool things?
So their indie games play around a little bit what we would consider sacred cows, almost, in terms of role-playing techniques. I have brought lots of examples. It makes for poor radio, but I figured you should come see the cool things we brought. So there is the idea of getting rid of the game master completely and having a GM-less game. There's many games that play with this in a couple of different ways. I like to signpost a few things. A very popular concept right now is this concept called emergent gameplay, and it's been around for a while. It's just right now it seems very buzzwordy. So what a Kickstarter shows, it's like, oh, this is emergent gameplay, and everyone's like, oh, emergent gameplay. What it means is the game has very simple mechanics, and it wants to inspire you to take those simple mechanics and come up with a complex situation off of it. A game that does this is Legacy of the Slayer. I think we picked this up at Metatopia. It is available online from the Game Crafter and other sources. How the game works is essentially you're going to build a deck based on your characters, who are monster hunters or other urban fantasy people. And so passion, dating, and you would build a deck, and you flip them over, and you actually lay out three, and then the person who is narrating just randomly picks a card, and this is like ability, witchcraft. Okay, now I have to set a scene involving the character who this card belongs to, and it's going to involve what you know, witchcraft, and because it's an ability, it won't necessarily be negative. But otherwise, other than the couple of starting prompts, that's all the game gives you.
Well, it does give you a deck and a procedure, and it says after so many cards, a plot twist is going to come up, and so you know, sitting down, I don't need a GM to pace this game. I don't need that. It's all the deck's taking care of that stuff. The deck's telling me who's in the next scene and what it's about, and then it's, you know, and then the players are just taking their inspiration from there. So it gives you enough to hang your hat on to start and do the next scene, but it's not. You know, it's sort of playing with that. Well, what can we really boil down a GM to and you know, make it as far away from D&D, but still provide the things it provides that you need to have a game? So that's pretty cool.
I'm just going to put this aside. There are games that play around with similar form factors, but with a lot more structure. So this is a 183 Days, which won a bunch of Indie Developer Awards last year. It is incredibly structured. There are two decks. It's a two-player game. You are playing two psychics who have the understanding that if they do not get into a relationship with each other, the world is essentially going to end. However, this relationship is going to end up as an emotional disaster for both parties. And you're flipping over cards in your deck, and it's prompting you. So one person would be, oh, in this situation, you're reminded of this part of your relationship with your parents. And then the other person's deck is, the other player seems really concerned right now. Maybe you should reach out and react to it.
And so what's really great about this game is there's no prep at all. You couldn't possibly, you've got your two decks and you read the instructions, and it takes you through a warm-up to get you in the zone about this, to get you thinking about these sort of things. And then, like, the next one is, here's the rules you're going to need, and here's, just react to this thing or think about this thing. It's just, you just read an instruction and then do that instruction immediately, and you're sort of counting down through the cards. They're all numbered, so you're doing it in sequence, and it really steps you through. It's another way of it's more structured than like a Legacy of the Slayer, which just says, here's a scene, and you go do your thing. And this is really, here's specifically this scene. Now think about how your character would feel now and consider and reflect on what they just said to you, which we sort of know because the game cheats and knows what's on both sets of cards. And so you're...
Yes, the game also has a weird psychological factor where it starts I suppose they have play tested and watched where certain things appeared in repeated sessions. So then the game starts predicting your actions, which is kind of creepy. And if I say any more, it's a bit of a spoiler. So this is available through Drive-Thru Cards. I think it's still technically in beta. I don't know if this is the finished product anymore.
But it, yeah, it has to be in order to win an IGN.
Okay. Sure. They were saying it was in beta a while back, so.
Yeah. So a couple of other games that get rid of the GM in other ways. I think there's the really classic Fiasco. It was one of the first ones to really take over the indie world as a GM-less game. And it's playing with genre, it's playing without a GM, and it's trying to go on those cues. It knows it's gonna be a fiasco, a disaster, a lot like a Coen Brothers movie, and then sets up all those really dynamic relationships with some random roles, and then just sort of says go. And you know, at the end of the scene did it end well or badly for me? And you pick a colored die, and there's, you know, that's the whole thing. There's a couple of rolls that throw a twist in there, but, and I think that one's got a lot of popularity because there's a couple of really, like the internet has like a bunch of replays of it, and there's things on YouTube where you can go watch them play it and figure out how it's working.
It's a very accessible game. It was one of the earliest story games that played around with form a lot. And thus, a lot of people are aware of it. It's also readily available because they did a huge print run on it. One of my favorite ones, because I like giant robots, is Firebrands. The Mobile Frame Zero Firebrands. Mobile Frame Zero being that Lego game that has mechas. Well, Vincent Baker, who wrote the setting for the game, wrote Firebrands, which is supposed to be about the soap opera-like interactions between the different pilots. And it's actually a series of mini-games that, if you're familiar with mecha anime, in particular, more of the real robots genre, Gundam, for example, you have your mini-games which invoke having all of the people in their mechs fighting at once. You have games which are about you seizing tactical targets. And then you have scenes which is, you're having a conversation over food. How is that structured in a way that actually makes this a game? Or you're going to steal time away together. I call this the sexy times minigame. How is that reflected? Because that game in particular is all based around consent. So it's like I make this sort of social move and I'm also doing this physical move at the same time. Do you let me do that?
And what I like about a lot of the games is a lot of the violence is really backwards to how you usually see it. It's you know, if you're attacking me, I'm going to tell you, hey, you're going to kill my best friend. Are you willing to kill my best friend? Okay, you do it. That's fine. God, I'm heartbroken. Are you now willing to kill all of those innocent people? Do you still want to fight? You're going to kill all those, you know, and it makes you, like, talk about the consequences of violence. And, hey, how far are you willing to go before you're, like, that's enough. We're done. I can't take any more of these consequences. So it's these really interesting inversions on the typical way you might approach that. And so it's awfully cool. It's another game that's GM-less. You each just
yeah. You each get a book. That's your play. This is your character sheet, and it walks you through building a character. It walks you through. It has a mini game called Solitaire because not all scenes are going to feature your character. So Solitaire is how do I advance my personal plot while no one's looking at me? And then you always have space to say, what have people heard about you recently? What have you been up to? Yeah. And that's how you get to announce, oh, well, really, I was going out with the rebels and building alliances there so we can attack the landowners who are based off-planet and trying to take over our stuff.
Well, and that's another way this game solves a problem that a GM in a more traditional game is on top of, and they're worried about, how do I balance the spotlight, and did I make sure this player got as much to do as that player? And it says, well, yeah, everybody's always got something to do. You may only have two or three people doing the one game, but you can always be playing this other game and come up with, aha, I got a surprise, and it's justified in the game, and I'm not just, you know, doing nothing or spinning my wheels or waiting my turn. I've always got a thing to do.
So another way we could play around with role-playing techniques is the idea of exploring the concept of the long-term campaign. As a community organizer, we see this a lot with people who want to join the community and are looking for essentially a lifetime campaign or a campaign that will last several years. A lot of indie games play around with this by presenting games that can be very fulfilling in a short amount of sessions or, in fact, just one sitting.
I mean, that was definitely the assumption when I first got into gaming was, yes, we're going to play this campaign and it's going to take us from first to 20th level and we're going to do everything, and I didn't inevitably get bored right away or after five sessions and be like, I'm not going to go forward anymore. I need to start something new, and I'm a horrible flake for that.
You killed a lot of games.
But luckily a lot of games that have solved that problem for me by only having one possible session ever. So the first one that jumped to mind was Monster Gear 1244. It's a really cool historical game about the Cathars and this real life situation, and you know they're being sieged, and it's all the politics of what's happening in the castle and who's believing what religion. It's this really interestingly researched situation that sort of tries to put you in that moment, and yeah, I mean it's never going to feel the horror that was actually there, but it gets you like. You know, it gets you there close enough, or gets you playing in that ballpark.
To give you a little bit more context, historically, it's about this 9-month siege based off of a religious situation. The Cathars being a splinter group of Christianity who were being pursued by the majority and hunted down. So they held up this castle, and you're playing for the 9 months, so you're skipping time every once in a while as things become more and more dire. And the end of the game, you're given the options, okay, after you've explored these characters, because you're balancing a couple different characters because you're playing NPCs for other people, does your character try to run away? Do you repent so you're not killed? Are you burned at the stake? In real life, 200 people trapped in this castle during the siege were burned because they refused to back down on their beliefs. So the question is, how can we empathize with these people who were put in the situation where they decided so resolutely that I will rather be executed right here than walk away or say, no, I didn't believe in it all along?
And so it's really interesting to examine that question. There's not a lot of ways that can make it as personal as after, hey, I've been 3 hours playing this character and having these things and trying to react to them. It gets you to that moment a little bit. It tries to get you in that space, and that's really cool.
The example I thought of was Ben Lehman's Amidst Endless Quiet, which is available as a PDF for fairly cheap, I believe, if not three. You're playing, so it's slightly unbalanced. You have the ability to have, I think, 6 players. You have 5 people who are examples of the greatest things humanity can do. And each of them are incredibly valid people who are important to the continuation of humanity.
So important, they're put on a spaceship, and when Earth is dying, sent to somewhere safe far across the galaxy. It's the only ship going, and it could only save 5 people, and these were the 5 they saved.
But there's a disaster that occurs on the ship. The ship's computer has to go through the memories and the dreams of these people in stasis and decide what's the one person you're going to save.
And so it's really cool. It boils you down to there's a timed element. The computer player only gets 20 moves. And so they've got a certain amount of, okay, I could wake this person up, but then I could never go through their dreams again. And it takes a certain amount of moves to load their pod into the thing and launch it. And so if you get to the end and you take too long making your decision, who's the right person to save, you might run out of moves to actually be able to save them. So it's this game of resources and which scene and what way am I going to learn the most about this person and decide between the 5 of them who's going to be the most worthy and the best example to save.
It's an emotionally intense game. It broke me about round 9 of 20, and I was like, I don't know. This is just disastrous. I want to save everybody. Why can't I save everyone?
It's really fun, and it's a single page. It all happens on one page printed out. There's no it's no big rule book. It's literally 1,000 words, and you're in this really cool space, and it's worth it.
So let's discuss play styles and lens focus. So, which is to say, taking genres that are very common, like the fantasy genre, and focusing that lens a little bit off to the side, because traditionally we have the murder hobos who are going about on their quests given by maybe a noble, maybe not. But in indie games, we do have the ability to examine different parts that could occur in that setting.
Yeah, one of my favorites that does this is Serpent's Tooth. It's this really cool game about, it takes the GM and makes them literally a character. And so they're a king, or they're a something in this fantasy kingdom, and they've got a crown and a castle and these other treasures. And they, when that player starts, they have all the normal GM powers. They get to say who's in what scene and where those scenes happen and what's at stake and what starts them. But as the players are going on, they're trying to capture in the fiction the castle and capture the crown and capture the sword. And when you have those things, you get that GMing power now. Either you might get to say who's in the scene, or so it's playing with this idea of okay, the GM is all powerful and is this perfect power mad thing, but also we're going to spread the power about as we go until, you know, you're trying to have all the crowns and beat the GM at the end of it. And so it's this really interesting way to maybe introduce people to that part of setting scenes and being the GM and being like, okay, yeah, but that's a thing you earned now. And so it, it puts it as a treasure instead of as a burden. And it's really fascinating.
Yeah, this is the special edition. It's a Ross Kalman game. He also wrote this one we'll talk about in a bit. There is a slightly cheaper version that's PDF because there most of the game is printable. There's sheets that reflect different parts of the King's Kingdom, which becomes the GM stuff that you take, and those move around the table. It's a fascinating game, particularly if you're well-versed and powered by the Apocalypse, because the powers of the GM are very reminiscent of the hard moves, almost word for word in some cases, except it's technically not a Powered by the Apocalypse game, which I find interesting.
Well, that, and that's another piece where you see a lot of, like, indie games are not a unified thing. They're a style that's commenting and interpreting and being influenced by all the other game design around them, and so it, it's sort of taking and reshuffling ideas in really interesting ways.
My favorite one to go to is Before the Storm, which is in Seven Wonders, which is a fantastic collection. You should definitely seek this out. It's sometimes difficult to get in print because it keeps selling out. It's put out by Palgrain. Before the Storm is a game that talks about the what happens the night before the battle that's going to change the fate of the world. Because you have a party of adventurers who know there's a prophecy, know that they are going to change the world, but the prophecy isn't clear if they win. And they have this one night, they may all die tomorrow and everything would be lost, but for now, they can air all their dirty laundry, and they can just cut each other down and find answers to questions that have been driving them mad in their relationship with each other. And it's really framed as you're sitting around the table, and you're pulling cards, and depending on the cards you randomly pull when you ask questions and you frame scenes, flashing back to, you know, when was the first time you were truly scared as an adventurer? And you would frame a flashback to, you would act out, okay, this is what we know about the character here, and then the character also gets to decide how they answer that question in character, which means that the truth gets twisted a little bit. The cards that you're pulling, playing cards, and that determines how likely your character is to live or die in the final battle, and how dire the situation gets for all of you.
I mean, and I really love it. Like, the game encourages you to be like, yeah, go with your friends and sit down around a table and order food that would be, like, of the theme of the area you're describing. So go have a big dinner and, you know, have this conversation over food that the game is wanting you to have. But it's so it, it's really talking about trying to get that atmosphere of, hey, this is the Last Supper before we take the golden sword and try and siege the castle, or else, you know, for all or nothing.
The author writes a lot of parlor LARPs, and I think she's just released a blockbuster LARP, so it does get a little bit LARPy, and there are LARP rules, but I've never run it completely head-on LARP. It's always been, let's sit there at the table, and usually it results in people yelling at each other. Last time I ran it, we had a foam sword, and it was being pointed at people, because this was the artifact that was going to save the world, except, well, people are going to friend each other with it right now, because why not?
Do you want to talk about Ryotama?
Yeah, so Ryotama is like one of my favorite games. I'm running it tomorrow. It is another example of, it's essentially an OSR game, which I find deeply fascinating. It does not look like any OSR game you have ever seen. But believe me, it's OSR. It focuses...
What's OSR mean?
Old school Renaissance or old school Revolution, depending on who you follow and what school of thought you cling to, basically. It is a short form for people who were really... fell in love with very old school D&D, so first edition or AD&D, and really want to bring gaming back to that space and feel that the games that came after are going a little bit too far afield and miss what the point of gaming is completely. So OSR is about going back to that. This is Japanese OSR, which gets a little bit more into genre because traditional gaming is specifically family genre, or not family, fantasy genre, rather than science fiction. That's not traditional gaming. It is, though, a game about traveling. It's a game where instead of the focus being on combats and skills, it is how do you set up camp? How do you roll on your stats? When you wake up in the morning, did you wake up on the wrong side of the bed? How does that affect the rest of your travel? Did you guys get lost? What mechanical effect does that have? It also, because it's intended as a game for newer GMs, it takes ideas that within the broader gaming community are kind of inside jokes or tropes that we're aware of, such as the GM PC. Everyone knows there's a GM who has their favorite pet PC, the one who steps in to help players when some things get bad. The game makes you build one. And your PC only becomes more powerful if your players do things on their own. So you have more sway to manipulate parts of the plot as your GM PC gains more powerful because you gave your players spotlight. It also can affect the tone of the game. So if you have, there's like blue dragons, which are the dragons of summer. Those are dragons that make stories about relationships and camaraderie. So you could say, oh, you're all schoolmates who went to school together. This is my GM fiat right now. Or you can play the black dragon, which is Dragon of Winter, which tells story of mystery and conspiracy, where your power isn't, we're going to establish what the connection is between the players, but I can, at one point during the game, automatically kill a PC, or sorry, an NPC, no questions asked, and that's going to drive the plot forward. Or there's now essentially a mental health mechanic where you have to roll on how you're dealing with the situation, the stress you're experiencing, which doesn't happen with other parts and other GM PCs. It's a little bit paper heavy because, again, it's very OSR-y. Highly recommend it, though. It's also the most lovely written RPG book I've ever read, where it's like, hey, if you're feeling good about it, try being a GM. And if you don't like being a GM, that's okay, because GMing's not for everyone. You're still valid as a player. Or, is this your first time role-playing? Go to the gaming store and find a set of dice that really inspires you and makes you feel about your character. That's the set you're going to buy.
So another axis that we can look at, like, what are some indie games and how are they playing with, you know, commercial tides? Traditional games are often, you know, a pencil, a paper, a whole bunch of dice. But there's a lot of games that sort of take away the dice or do something else and try and move that in a different direction. The one that jumps up to my mind as being really evocative is Dread, which is this horror game by Ebediah Ravishall. The main mechanic is a Jenga tower. And so as you're doing difficult things in the game, you're having to pull more and more blocks from this Jenga tower. And so, oh, you're trying to jump over the river to escape the monsters behind you? That's going to pull three. And you better hope you don't knock over the tower, because when the tower is knocked over, somebody dies. And so you're playing through this really cool tension-building mechanic, and it gets to, like, you know, you've got the high tower, and, God, do I risk going to save that guy? Because I might knock this over. And so it creates this really great drama between the physical objects and the mechanics of the game and the tension they're trying to build in the game itself, which reminds me of, there's a couple of games that have sort of taken inspiration from that. Alex Roberts is Building Tension, which is a game about relationships and a relationship, you know, a new one forming and the tensions in that, and that's sort of inspired by the Jenga tower. Or Epi's taken Dread and sort of made it one step meaner, where it's now this fantasy thing in the Dread Curse of Duke Volku, and Duke Volku's screwing around with you, and so you have to make two pulls, but because Duke Volku is involved in this somehow, you have to use your left hand now. Or you have to close your eyes. Or you have to, like, there's changes the way you have to approach that and to make it more dangerous or to feel like there's, you know, this outside force playing with you. And it sort of gets it not only in horror, but now you can feel that different, you know, hand reaching out and tilting the odds.
Oh, you can also just push the tower over and make a noble sacrifice. Make everyone sat at the table. That's what I do. Like, oh, you're going to live. I'm not. I'm going to walk away now. The game that I really like that works with building atmosphere and brings in gameplay mechanics that are more based around physical objects is 10 Candles. Or as I market it, that game where you set things on fire. 10 Candles, you literally have 10 tea light candles, and that's your countdown timer, your tension mechanic for the game. And as each scene passes, depending on how your players roll, eventually they're going to roll bad and you're going to snuff the candle out. It tends to get a little bit more trad because in order for you to build that tension mechanic, you have to force your player to roll on everything because everything's technically lethal. And because otherwise the game sort of stalls out. And as players, their character sheet in this context is a stack of index cards. And as they use parts of their character sheet, they set them on fire and burn them. So it provides a bright flame of light in the room, because you're playing in darkness with only these tea lights, for a brief moment, as that part of their character is snuffed out forever.
And there's a lot of cool ritual in that game, too, because as every scene ends and a light is snuffed out, you go through and add new facts about this world and move the scene along, and the last fact is always...
the world is dark.
And we're still alive.
It's still alive, but you can't say that in the last one. You only... Right. The world is dark and horrible. I don't remember the specific words off the top of my head. You also do this delightful and horrific setup at the beginning of the game where you pass around someone's cell phone and you record what, at the start of the game, your character's last words would be. And then in the darkness, you're supposed to play them and make everyone listen and feel really bad.
How hopeful you stood at the start of it all to feel where you're at the end of it. It's a really fun moment. It's got a lot of drama in it. Fire's always fun.
I have a fire extinguisher. The creator does encourage you not to use fire, I should say, for Stephen Dewey's, like, fire bad. I'm like, but I had a fire extinguisher right there the whole time.
That's where you get that one?
Pardon?
Where can you get that one?
So unfortunately, his distribution channels are a little bit unusual, so you actually have to go to Calvary Games and buy it around. If you go around Gen Con, he has free shipping, because he's never been to Gen Con, I think.
Hmm.
So he's like, just, it's free shipping worldwide. He might be having something else coming out soon, but.
And I think that the best example of a game that plays around with form factor that I've ever seen is Fall of Magic.
Have you guys seen Fall of Magic before?
It's
Do you want to see Fall of Magic?
It's this game about a journey. You should be thinking like Lord of the Rings or that sort of thing, where you're on a quest and you're trying to take the Magus to Umbra, where magic was born, to try and save the world. But it comes on a scroll.
This is the interactive part of the panel. This is Fall of Magic.
And so you're building your character on the first panel of the scroll. And then once everybody's got a character built, that rolls up, and you unroll the next bit.
So you start and you go location to location to location as the game continues.
And so you're telling these scenes and moving your pieces around the map, but you're moving forward in time, and it's got this... I mean, it's a map, so you've got this real feel for
spoilers.
Journey.
Our favorite part is, so you see the ocean. You can go across the ocean. You can also go underground to the back of the map.
Like it's so pretty. It's so evocative, and the game itself is very like internal and thoughtful. And you're having all of those like moments of doubt, and you know, Frodo, I don't think we can do this anymore. And like all those moments, the game is sort of walking you through places where you can get to that and have those times. It's really, really worth checking out.
So that's all the toys that we brought to show off. Does anyone have any questions about accessibility or possible direction in terms of games? Yes.
So that's like starting off, just play all the games in front of you. And that's cool if you're willing to, but how would you get other people?
Excellent question. So I would look up local gaming stores sometimes do indie nights or games that are not RPGs. You may have to take a lead on that situation and be the person who organizes those events to start it off. You can look into local gaming groups. We help organize one for Toronto. Conventions are a great way to go shopping in the convention game listings and say, what sounds interesting or what have I heard of and haven't accessed before? What has been a barrier for me to reach? Because that's what we do for cons, is basically go, I heard of that one, let's go play this, or I heard of this one. Online communities are fantastic for this. I work with the Gauntlet. The Gauntlet has, you have to sign up about 2 months in advance. Most of these games do have online versions. I don't know if Serpent's Tooth has in particular, but there is actually an online version of Fall of Magic for Roll20 that is much cheaper. In terms of accessibility, this is like $100. I think the online version might be like $10, and it loads everything to Roll20. So online helps. Organizing at a local level, you may have to carry some of that burden when you're sort of feeling out people who are interested in the same things you are or are willing to take a plunge.
And I think the other piece of it, too, is it's all about pitching games and trying to figure out what the barrier... Like, if you've got a group of friends and you want them to play a game, it's figuring out what the barriers for them are. And I know my favorite go-to is the second piece we led with you feel like you need to know something. That's a marketing trick. You're being fooled by marketing. You don't want to be fooled. Play this game now. You know, there's trying to figure out what the impediments are. Why familiar is always easy. And so it's taking the, hey, this is low commitment. This is a one shot. This game is just sit down once. You don't even need to know anything. We just read cards off the thing and go. Like it can You can find the games that lower that barrier, and I think the more games a person has played, the more likely they are to play more games. And so it's just finding the one that's got the lowest barriers that you can play, and find it and only play it once. And then be like, yeah, that was a thing, and I didn't love all of those things. And here's, I'm going to find a game that responds to all the reasons I didn't love that and play a different game from a different side of the perspective and be like, hey, this game was all the way over here. And talk about what we did and didn't like about those experiences and try and dial in the one that's like, ah, this is going to be the key to unlock the next thing.
Sure,
yeah.
That one of those games or some of those games have lower barriers regardless of who you are? Or are the barriers going to be lower and higher for different people? Or how do you pick which one's the lowest barrier?
I
was going to say it's going to depend on the person. It's also going to depend on your comfort level in terms of trying something new. And again, going back to this idea of emergent play. Because emergent gameplay produces a little bit of a flailing effect that can make people uncomfortable, which will produce more of a barrier. You do have other players who don't like restrictive games. When I talk to people in the Gauntlet about Firebrands, they feel it's too restrictive because all of my outcomes are listed. I want more freeform. So I think there is a level of self-awareness in terms of what do you enjoy in gaming? Do you like inhabiting the space that's your character? Do you like getting into the crunchy numbers? You want to find a game that meshes a little bit closer to what your tastes are before you go like completely nuts and try everything.
So I think, to me, the games that do tend to have a bigger barrier are just the games that are longer and more to read and more to internalize and more to try and figure out, especially if it's not one that I've played before or seen somebody play. So usually I think that, like, the lowest barrier games are your things like Lasers and Feelings, which is a two-sheet page that's got this whole great scenario on it that you're, you know, a Star Trek captain, and you're, you know, going on this ice, and you roll one die, and the whole thing, and it's, or I missed Endless Quiet, or those sort of. I find those have fewer barriers just because there's less words, and so the pitches are always really punchy because they've got to get as much said in as few things as possible. And I think my other trick to overcoming games that are longer is trying to find someone to run it for me, or going online and finding an actual play, or finding, you know, a podcast where they've played it, and just to get a sense of what's the rhythm of this game like. I'm willing to take the plunge and lead the charge and be the MC for it or whatever, but I need to just get a feel for the rhythm, and I find actual plays. That's what I go to them for, is I'd be like, oh, what's it sound like when we're playing this? What's Dogs in the Vineyard like? What is the tone everybody's aiming for? At least it gives you a place to start when you're trying to be like, hey, I've seen one or two examples of this. Maybe you want to think in this direction, other person I'm trying to teach it to.
Actual plays will also clarify parts of the rules that look a little unclear. I can think of multiple examples we listed where there's parts. Golden Sky Stories in particular, because I ran a big drop-in campaign in Toronto a couple years ago, people come to me with questions, and there's parts of that game that are written a little bit unclearly, mostly in terms of establishing relationships, and every few months someone comes and it's like, so how does this work again? Yes?
So a lot of the examples that you threw into this particular mix, I noticed, were ones that are really focused on playing the emotional space. Moving people from traditional games often involves getting them away from the gaming is a combat grind mentality. But a lot of the ones that you mentioned, as much as I love them, they're pretty far in the other direction. So what do you find are some good gateway games to get people moving into that space just a little bit to start playing around?
316 Carnage Amongst the Stars is one of my favorite games for this. This game is by Grant Howitt. It's a small little book. It's you're playing Space Marines who are out to kill all the aliens. This game has two stats: killing things, everything else. Because it's a game about killing things and everything else doesn't matter. And you know, you award experience points by the amount of people you've killed or the amount of aliens you've killed, and you go to another planet and you have this bug hunt on them. It's not about emotional feely space at all. There's a little bit of a like flashback of like, hey, where did you learn to do this thing? But it's very much you're these soldiers on a planet, and you do great by killing things, and you eventually want to level up and become the sergeant and become the major and get to call in the nuke and be like, fuck it, this planet, we're done. Boom, we're off. And it's short, it's punchy, it's It looks at what it's trying to do and just boils it down to this is everything you need to do to play a Bug Hunt Space Marine, and has nothing that is not about that.
It tends to break people of the combat habit, though, because when you're not measuring damage in terms of this is how many hit points, but in terms of body count, it tends to give people pause. You're like, oh, that wasn't like 30 hit points. That's 30 dead bodies there.
2d20 aliens? What? it's crunchy in some respects that way, but it's very much of this way, and it's not a feely game.
I find feely games, though, when you put someone who's willing to take the plunge, they do find it very rewarding. As I said, I read a Golden Sky Stories drop-in game, and we did have people who their only other experience was World of Darkness games. And like, okay, you're playing cute little animals right now. And that makes it a lot more accessible because it's very relatable. Because going to a more of a positive emotional space tends to be an easier space because people don't like feeling bad all the time. Some of these do make you feel bad. They don't always. But I think the games that do build more positive do encourage that challenge a bit more.
I mean, I think a lot of these games too. I'm looking at like Serpent's Tooth or Fall of Magic. They get out of them what you put into them. If you have a conversation beforehand, we're like, we want to make this pretty like gory and dark, and let's just see where we can do it that way, and not think so internally. When you get to some of the towns, you can just be like, oh yeah, it's fucking burning to the ground. Now what? You know, like you can put as much or as little of that as you want to in it. So as a way to ease people into it. You can start out on the map and be like, yeah, this is pretty hardcore. And if you're, you know, as you go, just start introducing prompts that are more and more, you know, maybe internally focused instead of externally focused. But you're in control of, in a lot of these things, where that dial sits. Sure. Anything else?
I think we're at time, basically.
I think it's pretty close, yeah.
Perfect. If you're able to and interested, Breakout Cons, March 16th to 18th in Toronto. It's 3 days of gaming. It's sort of a sister con to Queen City Conquest just across the border. It's worth checking out. Listen to our podcast, It's Like D&D, with the two of us and Kate, who was in the room a little bit earlier. And thank you for coming to our panel.